This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to RN Summer, where we'll bring you some of our most memorable conversations for the year. I'm Andrew West, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Here's a question you may think you know the answer to. He's been married 3 times and reputedly had numerous affairs. He's never had a conversion experience to Christianity or asked God for forgiveness. He's made a virtue of his machismo, but he avoided military service. And yet, he's a hero to 80% of America's white evangelical Christians. Kristen Cobes-Dumais is a professor of history and gender studies at Calvin College in the United States. She's written a new book, the title of which I'll reveal in a moment. But Kristen, who are we talking about?
We are talking about John Wayne,
the Hollywood actor.
I may sound like a Bible beater yelling up a revival at a river crossing camp meeting, but that don't change the truth none. There's right and there's wrong. You gotta do one or the other. You do the one and you're living. You do the other and you may be walking around, but you're dead as a beaver hat.
So, Kristen, the title of your new book is Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. How did John Wayne come as early as the late 1940s to be an aspirational model for white evangelicals?
So it's a long story, and it didn't happen overnight. Back in the 1940s, John Wayne really just became a movie star for all Americans, or for many Americans. He was the cowboy hero, the Western cowboy who could bring order to chaos and kind of this nostalgic view of American power. And then he became a kind of wartime hero on screen, just on screen, and first starring in World War II movies like The Sands of Iwo Jima, and then in time in Vietnam films like The Green Berets. And so he became this kind of icon of American masculinity, a very kind of militant model of masculinity. And by the 1960s and 1970s, white evangelicals were increasingly drawn to that model of kind of strong, tough, rugged masculinity, violent when necessary. It was a kind of antidote to feminism, to some of the disorder of the civil rights movement, and also to the disappointments of the Vietnam War. And so for white evangelicals who were coming together as a partisan political movement at this moment, and they were talking a lot about family values, at the heart of those family values was a kind of rugged and at times militant white patriarchal masculinity.
Yeah. Who had this great line that you quote in the book, that Jesus can save your soul, but John Wayne can save your ass?
Yes. So that was Baptist scholar Ellen Bean, who recognized this dynamic going on, that there's this kind of tension that you say we trust in God, trust in Jesus, but, you know, we're going to take care of things for ourselves here, and we're going to put our trust in our own strength, in a kind of militant strength. And all along the way, it was really critical that Christian men exhibited this strength so that they could defend God and Christianity and Christian America.
Why this book is so relevant at this time, and this is the reason I teased our listeners at the start by, you know, evoking John Wayne's, you know, 3 marriages and his numerous affairs and the fact that he'd never actually served in the military that he so revered, is that it's very relevant today because there is clearly a direct connection to President Donald Trump, which we'll explore in a moment. But let's just define our terms here. When you talk about white evangelicals, who are you talking about specifically?
If you ask evangelicals themselves, they will say that they are Bible-believing Christians and that they, you know, really emphasize the authority of the scriptures and the conversion experience, being born again, and have a very activist faith. But if you use that definition, you can really find evangelicals across the globe, and many Black Protestants in the United States would count as part of that category. I'm really talking about a particular group that coalesces in the 1940s around the National Association of Evangelicals. They love Billy Graham, and they're a community that's defined not by denominations and not even by doctrinal beliefs so much as a kind of consumer culture. They start to publish books, and this popular culture really begins to define what it means to be an evangelical today.
You come out of the evangelical movement, don't you? Because the book is written with an enormous amount of authority and inside knowledge. What's your background, Kristen?
I grew up in a conservative Christian home in a conservative Christian town in a very small town in Iowa, so rural background. I didn't grow up thinking I was evangelical. I grew up in a Dutch immigrant pocket of Northwest Iowa, actually, influenced by the Reformed Christianity. That said, as I grew up and as I got older, I was more and more influenced by conservative evangelicalism, largely through the popular culture. So I shopped at a Christian bookstore. It was the only bookstore in town. I listened to Christian contemporary music. I read Christian literature and I listened to Christian radio. And so I was very much kind of brought into the subculture and influenced by these teachings, not because of the church I attended, but because of the religious culture that I consumed.
It seemed to me, reading this really interesting book, Jesus and John Wayne, that are we talking here about an evangelical religion, or are we in fact talking about a culture, and a culture that's really very connected to the pop culture? Because mm-hmm. there'd be an awful lot of serious evangelical theologians, probably the people that you've worked with over the years, who would just not recognize anything rigorous or particularly Christian about a lot of this culture. I mean, is it a religion or is it a culture?
So I'm not as willing to divide those two categories. I think it is a religion and a culture. It's a culture that finds expression through religion and religion that finds expression through culture. So yes, there are definitely evangelical elites, theologians, leaders who are horrified by what they see happening in terms of evangelical politics today. But there are also leaders who have really promoted this ideology, and many of those are theologians as well. In fact, their theology itself is reflecting these cultural values. You know, so they'll be shifting their ideas on gender and on sexuality and on even the doctrine of the Trinity to correspond with this kind of culture wars political movement. And so I wouldn't want to divorce the two. And at the same time, I would say among some of the elites who would be pushing back against this particular kind of cultural expression, I think they've found in the last few years, certainly the last 4 years, that they aren't quite as influential as they imagined they were.
Yeah, well, this is the story that you bring out about a lot of elite evangelicals who basically found that they'd lost control of their flock back in 2015, 2016, when their flock started sort of rampaging towards Donald Trump. You're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN Summer. My guest, Kristen Cobes-Dumais, author of the new book, Jesus and John Wayne. John Wayne keeps popping up throughout this 300 pages of this really fascinating story. What is the direct connection to Donald Trump, though? Because it's a pretty clear line. All the attributes or the things that people saw as attributes appear both in 1949 with John Wayne and 2015 with Trump.
Right. So when I started just kind of looking into how white evangelicals talked about masculinity and manhood. And I started looking at this more than 15 years ago, and I did not know that Donald Trump was going to kind of be the final chapter of the story, or I don't know if it's final yet. But what struck me is so many of the books on what does it mean to be a Christian man really didn't quote the Bible all that much, despite, you know, being Bible-believing Christians. Instead, they looked to Hollywood heroes. They looked to Mel Gibson's William Wallace and Braveheart. They looked to mythical warriors and soldiers, and John Wayne just kept popping up. That was really interesting to me. These models of a very militant masculinity where, you know, you would need to use violence to bring about righteousness and order, and the ends would always justify the means. And I started to see how this aligned with and actually kind of supported evangelical political views at the time. This was in the early 2000s when I first really started paying attention. And I saw that evangelicals were disproportionately pro-war, pro-Iraq war, preemptive war, condoning the use of torture, embracing this aggressive foreign policy and militancy. And that fascinated me, and I started to look more closely and came to see that in their own communities, in their own churches and organizations, they too were propping up models of this kind of tough, sometimes ruthless masculinity, sometimes abusers of power. And this is a story of continuity, and it is really exacerbated under the Obama presidency, and it really comes into fruition in 2016.
But what you also sort of make the case for is that John Wayne becomes a proxy for these leaders or these aspiring politicians who themselves aren't especially religious. I like, for example, Barry Goldwater, the Republican ideologue who ran against Johnson in 64. He was a bit of an egghead, but he appears to appeal to this evangelical, growing evangelical constituency in a cowboy hat and cowboy boots. And then you've got the same. And then you've got the same again with Reagan, who was a hero to the Christian coalition. But Reagan himself was not a deeply Christian man. John Wayne's the artifice, in a way. If I can't be a good pastor, I can be like John Wayne.
Right. Well, exactly. The pattern is well established for decades before we get to Donald Trump. What was so interesting to me is I think one of the reasons that they looked outside of their own theological tradition for these models of quote-unquote Christian manhood was because men who were shaped by Christian virtues, like the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, you know, patience, kindness, gentleness, and self-restraint, those attributes didn't really make for this aggressive defender and protector of Christian America and of the interests of the religious right. And so they had to look outside of their fold, really, to find men who were not constrained by those traditional Christian virtues. And that's where we see this long pattern. And we absolutely see that in 2016 when they are, you know, looking to Trump as, in their words, their ultimate fighting champion, their strong man, and he would protect them, and he would do so precisely because he was not constrained by traditional Christian virtue.
Yeah, well, what did Robert Jeffress, who is probably one of the most significant evangelical leaders in the United States, say in his justification for the endorsement of Donald Trump?
He said, "I want the meanest, toughest son of a you-know-what that I can find, and I think that's where evangelicals are right now." And he was right.
Because there's a sense, and I noticed the New York Times brought this out in a recent piece, that evangelicals thought they were under threat and had been under threat for about 30 years.
I think you can extend that actually longer if you want, you know, and that's a theme that came through very clearly in my own research, this idea that evangelicals were fearful. But really the object of that fear changed initially in the Cold War. They were very afraid of communism, and that fear of communism justified a very militant and militaristic response. They were afraid of feminism, and so they needed to push back against that, and then secular humanism, and then they were afraid of liberals, and then they were afraid of Muslims. Muslims after 9/11, and there was always something to mobilize them, this fear that then demanded militancy. But when I took a closer look at how this was actually playing out, I came to see that in many cases, the militancy came first, and the fears were being stoked by particular leaders, by pastors, by leaders of organizations, by men like James Dobson of Focus on the Family, Mark Driscoll, Jerry Falwell, that these men were intentionally stoking fears, and often irrational fears, among their followers in order to justify their militant faith and really their ruthless approach to politics generally. And once you kind of flip that around, I think you can understand recent decades of evangelical politics more clearly, and you can understand what happened in the last 4 years.
I've got this theory. I don't claim it's especially original, and you actually entertain it in the book as well, Jesus and John Wayne, that one of the reasons that many white evangelicals actually became so tolerant of Trump's personal moral failings was they'd had the experience in the late 80s and the early 90s with the fall of those mega church pastors, all because of these sex scandals. I mean, they were kind of used to people that they'd looked up to having feet of clay, weren't they?
They were. But, you know, we have those really dramatic televangelist sex scandals in the 1980s. But even though it wasn't covered by the news so much in subsequent years, if you look back the last 15, 20 years, you also see scandal after scandal. And the Me Too era has really started to expose those scandals. And so the sex scandals didn't stop back in the 1980s. They have continued throughout evangelical culture. And there the patterns continue to repeat. The perpetrator is often very quickly forgiven. Often the victims are the ones who end up being blamed. And this is actually quite consistent with evangelical views of sexuality, which place the burden of purity, of perfect purity, on the woman. A woman has to either stay perfectly pure and not tempt a man who is not her husband, or if she's married, she needs to fulfill all of her husband's needs. And the husband, meanwhile, or the man, is understood to be filled with testosterone. And that's, you know, for very good purposes, to make him the strong warrior. But it will also make him, you know, he'll have a hard time restraining himself, I think we can say. And so these are just side effects of God-given masculinity. And crossing a line in terms of sexual impropriety is kind of, you know, more easily forgiven because boys will be boys.
But there's a line. From maybe it was Russell Moore, who's actually a pretty respectable mainstream conservative evangelical. He said something in the 2016 primaries when he divided up the white evangelical electorate. Didn't he say that Donald Trump had the Jimmy Swaggart wing of the of the white evangelicals? Jimmy Swaggart being one of those televangelists who got caught up in a sex scandal in the late 80s.
And then I guess the question is, well, how big is that wing today, right? And I think it was much bigger than Russell Moore anticipated. And others pushed back against him at that point, too, and said, no, you know, don't divide us up. We're going to unite here. And that's, in fact, exactly what happened. And they united behind Donald Trump, the Jimmy Swaggart candidate. Mm.
You're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN Summer. Our guest this week, Dr. Kristen Cobes-Dumais. She's the author of the new book, Jesus and John Wayne. Tell me about this deeply sexualized element of white evangelical culture. You've referred to a bit of it there, but you mentioned a character called Mark Driscoll, who was a very popular sort of youth preacher, I think from the Pacific Northwest. He said things in sermons that would repulse a lot of conventional conservative Christians. What sort of a figure was he, and how was he able to last so long as an influential evangelical leader?
Oh, he was incredibly crass, misogynistic, would preach these sermons and put them online. He was one of the first pastors to really kind of master digital media. He was admired for that, that he was kind of this innovative, very successful, influential young pastor in the 1990s and early 2000s. But he was also, again, very crass, very misogynistic, and that all kind of went together in his success. So he kind of broke the rules. He was edgy. He was courageous. He was not to be constrained by political correctness or by traditional conservative values that would make a man soft. He was bold. He was courageous. And that was a model of masculinity, particularly by the late 1990s and especially in the early 2000s, that was extremely attractive to other evangelical pastors. And so he becomes this kind of hero. And even among the respectable evangelicals who weren't quite sure what to make of him at first, these more respectable pastors had to say, well, you know, he's doing the Lord's work here and maybe we can learn from him. And so he was incredibly influential among other pastors and among a generation of young evangelical men who listened to his sermons and wanted to model their lives after him, to be kind of rugged, bold, courageous, and even crass as necessary.
Well, he pushed the bounds even of, frankly, decency. And a lot of people would think he veered into sacrilegious language because, yeah. You know, and a warning here, didn't he say in a sermon that a young Christian woman should go home and pleasure her husband orally and say that it was a gift from Jesus?
Yes, absolutely. He was very explicit, talked about sex all the time in precisely that way, and then looked up to the Song of Solomon for his biblical proof text there. It's shocking, right, to an outsider. That was kind of his brand, and that starts this kind of thing. It wasn't just Driscoll. Other evangelical pastors tried to copy that. You'll have this kind of smoking hot wife phenomenon that goes through conservative white evangelicalism, where these pastors and leaders like to talk about just how sexy their own wives are, and that kind of proved their own virility. So women were supposed to be very sexually attractive and hyper feminine and submit to their husbands. And then men could kind of rule over them. And this was the way that God designed things. So it's hyper sexualized. And you can see how this could then cause some difficulties, not just in relationships and in marriages, but when it came to things like sexual abuse and forcing women to submit to their husbands' demands.
Mark Driscoll also described Jesus as being like a construction worker, a rough, tough construction worker. When we talk about all these attempts to recast the image and the person of Jesus, I always thought Jesus was the Lamb of God. But that seems to be completely anathema to this idea of some of these evangelical leaders.
It is. Their favorite book of the Bible is Revelation, where you get a lot of blood and a lot of fighting, and where, you know, Christ is kind of depicted in this kind of apocalyptic warrior imagery. And so that's where they'll spend a lot of time and completely neglect, if not ignore, discount, reject passages, you know, where Jesus says, take up your cross and follow, to love your neighbor, to love your enemies. They reject those teachings and say that you can't be a proper Christian man if you turn the other cheek. You need to toughen up. And all of that kind of pacifism is great for after, you know, Jesus comes back and slays all of his enemies. And until then, you need to fight.
What were the attempts, Kristen, that were made by conservative evangelical men, mainly in the 1990s, to actually overcome some of this aggressive, hypersexual, angry tone? Because they weren't always successful, but you do give at least some modest credit to some efforts, I think. There was a group which had a very ambiguous feel about it called Promise Keepers.
Yes, the Promise Keepers in the 1990s. The 1990s are such an interesting moment for this history because the Cold War had come to an end. And up until that point, the Cold War had really framed all of these calls for militancy, the communist threat. They're anti-God, anti-family, anti-American. And so that justified this aggressive militancy. And then the Cold War comes to an end. We're in the 1990s. It seemed like feminism was here to stay. Women women were in the workforce. It was this time of questioning. A confusion was the word that just kept coming up. What does it mean to be a Christian man in this moment? And the answers were varied. Even though feminist critics looked at the Evangelical Promise Keepers movement in the 1990s, which was very visible, drawing hundreds of thousands of men to marches in the nation's capital and gathering in football stadiums. So it was very visible, and they thought this was this, you know, reactionary conservative organization, when in fact, there were some egalitarian impulses, and especially many of the leaders wanted to move away from this kind of macho masculinity, thinking it was just no longer tenable. They needed to kind of rediscover more of a tenderness and bring tenderness into masculinity. And so they talked not just of warriors, but of tender warriors. And this was all the rage for a few years during the 1990s. And this also was the moment when white evangelicals and Promise Keepers in particular reached out in a gesture of racial reconciliation and invited Black men into this movement. By the late 1990s already, there was a backlash brewing against this softer, kinder, gentler masculinity.
Yeah, so sissified, I think the critics say.
Sissified,
this is making Christian evangelical men sissies if they go along with this pledge to step up and do their bit at home.
Yeah, be a good dad, help your wife out. These rallies, too, were quite emotional. So they would worship and they would raise their hands and they would hug each other and there was crying. And that just seemed to critics a step too far. And so they wanted to man up, to toughen up. So this backlash was already in full swing when 9/11 happens, when the terror attacks on the U.S. take place in 2001. And that really just catalyzed this return to militancy, hyper-militancy. And that's when we have really Mark Driscoll coming into his own. We have John Eldredge's book, Wild at Heart, which sells more than 6 million copies. And it just seemed like Christian men had gone soft. And now we have a real enemy attacking us, attacking our faith and our nation. And we need to man up and we need to fight.
Just finally, Kristen, the reason I guess I keep coming back to this question of culture, and pop culture in particular, is not in any way to exculpate a particularly toxic theology, but it is to ask this question about whether white evangelicalism could have ever been the political force that it has been without the notion of celebrity, because everything is attached to celebrity with them. I mean, there's this case, for example, during the Obama years of this TV show called The Duck Dynasty, and the producers of Duck Dynasty took out the explicitly religious bits, but they kept in certain cultural things that evangelicals would be able to identify. That's us.
Yes.
Can this movement actually survive without having piggybacked and indeed shaped the popular culture?
It would be hard to imagine it. I mean, even from the days of Billy Graham, they kind of coalesced as a movement around the celebrity of Billy Graham and then around other celebrities. And, you know, Oliver North was a great celebrity. And
yeah,
and
Oliver North now, being a rogue military officer in the late 1980s who was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yeah, inexplicably, until you really understand this culture, he becomes their hero. I mean, just the model of Christian manhood. But you're right, without the celebrities at the center, it's hard to see that this value system would continue. And they've got, you know, kind of local celebrities, local pastor celebrities, and then they've got kind of the Hollywood celebrities, the Duck Dynasty clan. And now, frankly, Donald Trump has become one of their celebrities.
And let me just say, it's no coincidence that I think at his first ever White House prayer breakfast, what was Donald Trump's prayer? It wasn't for world peace or social justice. He prayed for Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings after Schwarzenegger took over The Apprentice.
Right. That is so right. Yes. And that's where we're at.
Kristen Gobez-Demey, author of Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And that's it for this week here on RN Summer. Catch us anytime on the ABC Listen app or at iTunes. Thanks to Mutita Dias and Emrys Cronin. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.